and welcome to the May edition of the Astropod. I'm still your host, Quinton Goddard.
And I'm Anna Quiter.
So, Anna, what's coming up on this month's show?
Well, we'll have the news and the sky at night, the history section, and everybody's favorite part, the joke.
And, you know, I'm really excited this month, Anna, because I'm speaking with Jonathan Fay from Microsoft about his new venture, the Worldwide Telescope, which is basically an amazing virtual observatory that you, right there at home, can get involved in.
Yeah, Quincy, I went to a presentation on the Worldwide Telescope, and it turns out it even has 3D capabilities.
Well, yeah, I mean, it really is a fantastic piece of software. So if you want to find out more, keep on listening. And if you want to go try it out for yourself, you can go to www.worldwidetelescope.org. So, Anna, turns out space stinks.
Really?
Well, apparently so. Some crazy astronomers have found a whole range of molecules out there in space and tell me that it smells of something.
Well, what does it smell like?
Well, Anna, it turns out it smells like rum, but it might taste like raspberries.
How on earth could they know that space tastes like raspberries and smells like rum?
Well, I think this is a pretty big guess, Anna, to be honest. Essentially, what they're saying is they found a whole range of molecules sitting out in space, which is pretty hard to do. I mean, each molecule gives off sort of a fingerprint, as you will. But the problem is, these fingerprints tend to overlap, so when you're looking at things in space, it's really hard to tell what molecules are actually out there. But they've managed to find a whole range of molecules now, ranging from alcohols to aldehydes, and things like ethyl formate and N-propyl cyanide, in a region of space called Sagittarius B2, which is near the center of our galaxy.
I would imagine that those molecules could play into life in space. Is that true?
Well, nobody's quite sure of how, you know, reactions really work in space. They are trying to find amino acids, which are the building blocks of life in space, but nobody's quite found them yet.
That's really interesting, but how do these molecules get out there in space?
Well, Anna, that's an excellent question. And the problem is, we can't really recreate the conditions of space in the lab, so we have to make guesses. Now, scientists have got sort of two competing theories at the moment. One is that these molecules have formed on sort of reaction surfaces, so forming on grains of dust out in space. And the other idea is that, in fact, there are building blocks of molecules floating about, and these hit each other, and then sort of form longer chains into bigger molecules.
Well, we can ask the astronaut who's going to be repairing the Hubble Space Telescope what space smells like when he goes out there on May 12th to fix Hubble for the final time.
They're finally getting around to fixing Hubble. So what are they repairing this time?
So they have a really full docket for the repairs to Hubble. They're going to be repairing the batteries and the gyroscopes, as well as fixing the advanced camera for surveys and the spectrograph. So this is quite a very intense mission.
So how many more years are we going to get out of a Hubble?
Well, they're estimating that it's going to last into the middle of the next decade. And the sad thing is that when Hubble's batteries finally do die and the gyroscopes finally go, and we can't really control the Hubble anymore, they're just going to let it crash in the ocean.
Well, this sounds like a very sad end for what has been probably the most successful human experiment, you know, in the history of mankind.
That's true, but if you're really interested in seeing the Hubble, there's actually a perfect replica in the Smithsonian Institute in the United States. So you could always take a trip over to Washington to see it in its full glory. Well, also coming up, it's a big time in May for the launch of Planck and Herschel.
It is exciting. So I hear they've put both of these satellites into one rocket. Is that really wise?
Well, my mother has always told me not to put all my eggs in one basket, so apparently astronomers haven't heard that one.
Well, they're taking a gamble, that's for sure. But these are being launched, what, on the 14th of May?
Yeah, on the 14th of May. So hopefully some good science will be coming out soon after that.
Double celebrations all round in astronomy departments.
Yeah, I've heard that we're actually going to be watching the live launch here at the Institute of Astronomy.
That should be a cracking event. So, well, let's get on with the show. So coming up next is the news section with Laura.
Hi, I'm Laura, and welcome to this month's Astro News. The Quiet Sun. The Sun is currently going through a quiet period, a solar cycle that traces the activity of our nearest star, such as sunspots, solar flares, and coronal mass ejections, is currently at a minimum. The solar cycle usually lasts around 11 years, with periods of frenetic activity characterized by huge flares and mass ejections from the Sun's surface, many sunspots, and a strong solar wind, followed by periods of relative quiescence, with few sunspots or outbursts. The most recent solar maximum was from 2000 to 2001, and since then the Sun's activity has declined. Until last year it was in the period of minimum activity. Things should now be hotting up again after this quiet spell. However, scientists are instead seeing a 50-year low in solar wind pressure and radio emission, and a 100-year low in sunspot activity. there's been some talk about mini ice ages, such as that seen between 1645 and 1715, known as the Maunder Minimum, when astronomers observed only 50 sunspots rather than the usual 30 or 40,000. This coincided with a period of bitterly cold winters when many rivers froze, known as the Little Ice Age, but whether or not this was caused by the lack of solar activity is still a subject of debate. So, are we entering another Maunder Minimum? According to Hinode, a Japanese satellite that monitors solar activity, there may be new evidence of the slow beginnings of the next solar cycle, with the appearance of a few new sunspots. The next solar maximum is due to occur in 2010, and some predict it will be even more spectacular than the last. Earth analogue spotted by HARPS. GL581 is an M-dwarf star two-thirds less massive than the Sun and only a tenth as bright. The newest planet discovered around it is GL581e. This is the fourth planet found in this system and has only twice the mass of the Earth and an orbital period of 3 days. This newly discovered planet was spotted by the HARPS instrument on the 3.6-meter ESO telescope in La Silla, Chile, and is the smallest extrasolar planet yet found. HARPS monitors stars, looking for wobbles caused by the gravitational pull of orbiting planets. The other three planets in the GL581 system all have masses less than Neptune. The outermost planet in the system, GL581d, has an orbital period of 67 days, which has been revised down from the estimate of 82 days from earlier data. This shorter period places GL581d in the habitable zone of the star. The habitable zone of a star is the orbital region where a terrestrial planet could hold permanent liquid water on its surface, and is so one measure of how likely a planet is to be able to sustain life. Habitability depends not only on the distance of the planet from the star, which determines its temperature, but also on factors such as the planet's mass and whether it could hold an atmosphere and so create the surface pressure necessary to sustain surface oceans. The amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is also crucial, as this can create a greenhouse effect and help raise the surface temperature enough to stop water freezing. Regardless of GL581d's potential to harbour life, GL581 is a fascinating system with four low-mass planets that has great potential for future study. Astronomers glimpse most distant explosion. A faint gamma-ray burst captured on 23rd of April by NASA's Swift satellite has smashed the record for the earliest, most distant known object in the universe. A gamma-ray burst, or GRB, happens when a massive star, maybe 100 times more massive than the Sun, explodes in a supernova. With a redshift of about 8.2, GRB 090423 went off in the constellation of Leo and lasted about 10 seconds. The infrared afterglow was then observed using the Gemini North Telescope in Hawaii and the VLT in Chile. This afterglow was used to find the redshift of the burst, which measures how much the universe has expanded since the blast happened. This means that the GRB exploded just 630 million years after the Big Bang, and the light has taken more than 13 billion years to reach us. This GRB is not just record-breakingly far away, it also takes us one step closer to understanding the nature of the first stars formed in the universe. That's all for this month's Astro News.
Since this month's interview is about the World Wide Telescope, which compiles data from many astronomical surveys, we're going to give you a brief history of the Messier catalog and the new general catalog. Charles Messier was a French astronomer who lived from 1730 to 1817. In his teenage years, he became enamored with astronomy because he saw a six-tailed comet in an annular solar eclipse. Instead of a formal education, his brother trained him in administrative duties. At the age of 21, he was fortuitously employed by an astronomer of the Navy, whom he assisted with record keeping. His employer taught him the basics of astronomy and astronomical observing, and his first recorded observation is the transit of Mercury in 1753. Messier's astronomy career really got started while searching for Halley's Comet, which was predicted to return in 1758. While looking for this comet, Messier discovered a different comet, as well as a comet-like patch in the night sky, which today we know as the Crab Nebula. So began Messier's career as a comet hunter and a cataloger of astronomical objects that could be confused with comets. In 1781, he published the Messier Catalog of 103 objects, and the 20th century astronomers decided to attribute 7 more objects to Messier, bringing the total number of Messier catalog objects up to 110. Now, there are a wide variety of objects in this catalog, including galaxies, globular and open clusters, diffuse and planetary nebula, and even a supernova remnant. The objects are named M and a number, where the number usually corresponds to the order of the discovery of the object. For example, the Andromeda Galaxy, which is the closest spiral galaxy to the Earth, is named M31, meaning that it is the 31st object in the Messier catalog. The Messier catalog names are still in use today. Because Messier was working with a small telescope of only about 10 centimeters in diameter, the objects he discovered are some of the closest objects to the Earth, and therefore they make for the most spectacular viewing with current telescopes. The Messier catalog was particularly impressive to William Herschel, who's a famous German-British musician, telescope maker, and astronomer who lived from 1738 to 1822. He lived in England and had the best telescope in the world, which had a 120-centimeter diameter lens. With his telescope, he and his sister Carolyn set about cataloging the northern night sky, culminating in about 2,500 objects. His work was carried on and extended to the southern hemisphere's night sky by his son, John Herschel. In 1864, John Herschel published about 5,000 objects in the General Catalog of Nebulae and Clusters of Stars. Over the years, astronomers were making many observations and publishing them in their own small catalogs. In the late 1800s, the astronomer John Louis Emile Dreyer, director of the Armagh Observatory in Northern Ireland, was asked by the Royal Astronomical Society to compile a new general catalog of non-stellar objects. The new general catalog of nebulae and clusters of stars was published in 1888, with two updates in 1895 and 1908. In total, there are 13,166 objects counted in the new general catalog, and they are designated by the prefix NGC and a number. The NGC names are still in use today. Today there are numerous sky surveys which range in size and scientific objective. One well-known modern sky survey is the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, which currently has data on a remarkable 230 million celestial objects, and it covers one quarter of the celestial sphere. Needless to say, computerization has certainly revolutionized astronomy. Pictures of and information on objects from the Messier catalog, the New General catalog, and modern catalogs are all available through the World Wide Telescope. And now to tell us more about the World Wide Telescope, here's Quinton and Jonathan.
Hello and welcome to the May edition of the AstroPod, and this month I'm chatting to Jonathan Fay from Microsoft. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Thank you.
So Jonathan, today you're going to be chatting to us about the World Wide Telescope, which is a fantastic online resource for, well, basically anyone interested in astronomy. I wonder if we could just start off by you giving us sort of a brief introduction to this new resource.
World Wide Telescope is an application that sprung out of the research that Jim Gray, who was a Turing Award-winning Microsoft researcher, much of the technology of behind ATMs and airline ticketing and things like that came out of the concepts that he invented. But he had this concept of astronomy being in a revolution where it had gone from being purely an observational science to more of a data processing science, at least from a research standpoint. But he also believed in the democratization of science and felt that all this data that astronomers were collecting should be available as publicly as possible. So the World Wide Telescope sprung out of that. Unfortunately, we lost Jim Gray in a boating accident. He disappeared a few years ago and was never seen from. But we really felt to honor him that we should continue his passion and create a product that would allow everyone from astronomers to the general public to be able to have access to this vast amount of wealth of astronomy data and imagery and be able to understand its context. So World Wide Telescope is a universe browser that allows you to look at the Earth, the planets, the deep sky, and the cosmos as a whole, and explore it interactively using a computer. We have a version that will run on a Mac or a PC and a website, as well as a version that's a Windows install. And it uses game type technology to produce a 3D interactive, immersive experience.
And this really is a fantastic piece of software and a massive step up from previous pieces of astronomy software which I've used. Just some, what are the major differences between the World Wide Telescope and, say earlier, planetarium type pieces of software which allow you to see what there is in the night sky?
Principally, we're actually, instead of creating a simulation of the night sky, we're actually using the imagery from real astronomy instruments. Most astronomy packages were installed off a CD-ROM or maybe even a small download application. And we are a relatively small download application. The difference is there are terabytes and terabytes of information that are on the web that are downloaded in real time as you view them. So the same way you might use Virtual Earth or Google Earth to browse the Earth, this uses a similar type of technology. Interestingly enough, pioneered by Jim Gray, to view the universe. And so you get a much more immersive feel. We've also tried to dispense with the decorating the sky with lots and lots of pushpins and lines and bullet points and text that usually gets in the way of really appreciating the beauty of the imagery, to give you more of an experience of looking up at the sky and seeing the sky. And we've also provided a way to see everything from radio waves, microwaves, infrared, optical light, ultraviolet, X-ray, and gamma rays as full sky surveys, as well as detailed studies of individual objects. So people will be able to look across the spectrum, and that's that type of multispectral planetarium just really hasn't existed in the past.
So this isn't just a visualization tool. This is actually a proper virtual observatory where I can pick any object and any wavelength and see what's out there.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, we're making this tool to be as friendly to research scientists as possible so that they can make use of the visualization quality data that also makes for great public outreach and education, but it can also be used to help them accelerate their investigations, because then they can preview different bands of data, figure out what they want to look at, and then use the World Wide Telescope to do queries from virtual observatory servers to get additional imagery, additional catalog information, and then actually exchange it with other professional astronomy tools. So it can be used from anything from a six-year-old who just wants to see the planets spin around to a professional astronomer who wants to go hunting for data on the virtual observatory.
Now, many of our listeners are sort of people interested in astronomy. They're not necessarily scientists. Just what kind of things can they use the World Wide Telescope for?
Well, one of the principal tools, Curtis Wong, who was the manager of the original implementation of the project, has this concept of creating an environment that has rich interactive tools along with a way to inspect data and combining it with a narrative element. So narrative meaning when you sit down and watch a science show on TV, you have these scientists who come in and talk to you about different interesting space topics while they show you these beautiful pictures. And that gives a way to explain what's happening from a scientific standpoint and educate people. But unfortunately, you might be able to pause the TV, but essentially all you do is see a static image. In World Wide Telescope, we have these things called tours that allow professional astronomers and educators to actually guide end users through space. And when the end user wants to, just like a good tour guide in a museum, they can stop and go off and explore on their own. And unlike a museum where the guide might have moved on, the guide actually waits for you. And when you're done exploring on your own and using all the tools in World Wide Telescope, you can hit the play button again and continue on where you're at. So the tour can guide you through the entire universe and show you different things, from, again, the surface of a planet And in fact, in one mode, we call it the solar system mode, but it's more of a universe exploration mode. You can actually sit in go down to a soccer pitch or a football pitch in Manchester and look at the goals, and then zoom back out and see the entire large-scale structure of the universe almost past the distance of the light cone of the Big Bang. So this comprehensive ability to bring all this data in, from planetary data to deep sky to the stars to galaxies and the structure of the universe into one application, really presents a great way for people to learn about the universe. So the tours are definitely the first place to start.
Yes, now I've played with some of the tours, and they really are a fantastic introduction to various aspects of astronomy and cosmology. Now, all of this is free, which is fantastic, but just what exactly is, you know, Microsoft's idea, and why do Microsoft want to get involved in, you know, such a very complicated but fascinating and useful tool for astronomy?
Microsoft Research is one of the world's largest research organizations, and our charter is to do a lot of pure research that's going to eventually produce discoveries that will be useful for Microsoft and the world in general. Oftentimes we work with other research organizations, and Worldwide Telescope is a project never would have happened without the support of other organizations, from NASA, Caltech, Space Telescope Science Institute, Chandra, Spitzer, the Digitized Sky Survey, and then people like here at Cambridge University that we're working with. This collaboration is something that is important for us. From it's also important for Microsoft as a company to you know, help invest in science infrastructure, because we feel that for you know, as a company, a world in which people are more trained in science and technology is one in which there'll be employees to work at for Microsoft, and people who will be able to use the technology and in a better way. And so it's something that helps the entire ecosystem. And of course, you know, our chairman and other people in the organization have shown a great commitment to furthering science from a charity standpoint as well. And so it's our way to give back to the community, and especially to remember Jim, who really dedicated his life to making this possible. And now that he's gone, we wanted to do something that the world could use in his memory.
I guess, I mean, the Worldwide Telescope is now a sort of almost fantastic collaboration, and is fantastically useful not only as an educational tool, but now becoming more of a research tool as well. Just where do you see the Worldwide Telescope ending up in the future? What are the sort of exciting things over the horizon that we can look forward to?
So we're going to continue to evolve in terms of becoming a more of a productive science instrument. And of course, at that time, keeping those tools accessible to the public. Some of the areas that we're going to be going into is recently we announced a partnership with NASA to take all the planetary data system data, which is of all these NASA missions that have gone and explored different planets, and especially Mars and the Moon in detail, and these new projects like the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, and get that data readily accessible to the public in very high detail, with science quality visualizations that will give people the access to a lot of things that have been only accessible to scientists until recently. Additionally, we really are going to provide a lot more tools for doing Earth environment studies. We're one of the few GIS type tools that can explore the Antarctica, look at things like ice sheets and things around the poles that we're uniquely able to handle given the nature of our tool. And also interactive simulations where you can see things like maybe a globular cluster that's being rendered in real time as all the stars orbit each other. And those are technologies, as people get higher performance graphics cards, that they'll be able to see these very interesting simulations that are interesting to scientists for the research value, but to the general public, and that they're just wonderful eye candy and let you see about the beauty of how the universe works.
Well, it really is a fantastic resource, and I think that's all we've got time for this month, Jonathan. So thanks very much for coming on the show and chatting to us about the Worldwide Telescope.
Well, thank you for having me.
Now, I really encourage everyone to get involved, and if you want to go and download the Worldwide Telescope for free, just go to www.worldwidetelescope.org. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Quincy and Jonathan. Now here's Alex telling us what's in the sky this month.
Up in the skies this month, following on from the Lyrids, this month's meteor shower is the Eta Aquarids, visible on May the 6th and seeming to radiate from the constellation Aquarius in the east. Although the predicted observed rate is about 20 to 40 meteors per hour, the moon is nearly full, and so its light will overwhelm most of them, meaning the observed rate will probably not reach higher than 20 per hour. As I mentioned last month, meteor showers are caused when the Earth passes through the debris tail of a comet, and these meteors are all debris from one of the most famous, Halley's Comet. Early in the morning on May the 2nd, Venus is at greatest illuminated extent, meaning that the sunlit area appears to be largest as seen in a telescope. This is about when Venus is at its greatest brilliancy, and so it will be bright for the rest of the month. This is probably the final good month to observe Saturn, as it starts to dim and the rings begin to close. They will start at 4 degrees from edge on, and so visible with a small telescope, but as the month goes on, they will steadily close until finally reaching edge on, which is where they'll stay for most of the rest of this year. Saturn can be found below the body of Leo. And finally, the 1st of May is known as May Day and comes from an ancient Gaelic festival to celebrate the midpoint of spring, originally designed to be halfway between the March equinox and June solstice, although this year this will actually occur on May the 5th. And that's it for the sky at night this month. Now back to Quinton and Anna.
Thanks for that, Alex. I'll be sure to check out the night sky this month. And now, as regular as the lunar cycle, it's the astronomy joke of the month. Over to you, Michelle.
Hey, Bodwell.
Hey, Michelle.
How are you doing?
I'm good, how are you?
Been doing much sound engineering of late?
I do nothing but sound engineering.
Brilliant. How would you like to hear a joke, Bothwell?
I would love to hear a joke.
Drum roll, please. Why don't astronauts eat when they get into space?
I don't know.
Because they've just had a big launch.
Thanks, Michelle. That joke was a real doozy.
Doozy, Anna? I think you mean snoozy. I'm sorry, that was even worse than the actual astronomy joke of the month. It appears as if Michelle's ability is infecting myself. Anyway, it's been another cracking AstroPod, and thanks very much for listening.
Thanks, see you next month.